You see, in 2010, we were tired of high unemployment, budget deficits, stifling taxes, and rising college tuition. Most of all, we were tired of the big government union bosses running our state and local governments. We had had enough, so we did something about it. We took the power from the hands of the big government special interests and returned it firmly into the hands of the hardworking taxpayers. You remember, in turn, the big government union bosses and their cronies in Washington helped organize more than 100,000 protesters who occupied our state capitol. They tried to intimidate us with threats and mobs, but we didn't back down, and we won.
At the Republican National Convention of July 2016, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker spoke proudly of surviving a landmark recall election after a tumultuous time when hundreds of thousands of protesters filled the state capitol building. Why does Wisconsin seem to have a political climate of extremes? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Not only in Wisconsin, but across the nation, people are trying to explain what seems an unprecedented political divide and an us-versus-them mentality. Going beyond the Republican-Democratic divide, my guest today explores the split between people living in urban and rural areas. Catherine J. Kramer is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the director of the Morgridge Center for Public Service, as well as an affiliate faculty member in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication, the La Follette School of Public Affairs, the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, the Wisconsin Center for the Advancement of Postsecondary Education, and the Center for Community and Nonprofit Studies. Her most recent book is The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin and the Rise of Scott Walker. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily. Thank you so much for having me.
I think the last time we spoke, you were traveling around the state doing field work, listening to people in coffee shops and gas stations and all over the state, trying to make sense of how they talk about politics and how they do that in sort of various groups. It seems this book, The Politics of Resentment, grew out of that work. Can you talk about just, first of all, why did you decide to do sort of field work listening to people talk?
Sure. So I study public opinion, and I've learned over the years that one of the best ways to, for me, to learn about how people make sense of politics is to sit down and talk with them and listen to them. I use polling data quite a bit, but I found that polls can give us a good snapshot of what a population of people think at a given point in time. But the question that has always interested me is, why do people think what they think? And I find that when I'm listening to them talk with other people whom they know, that I get a better sense of what kind of things they're piecing together in their minds to come up with a choice or a point of view about a given issue. So I wanted to just invite myself into conversations. I didn't want to invite people to come to talk to a university researcher or have focus groups or something that was more formal or more constructed like that. I just tried to find groups of people meeting with one another and invite myself into their conversations. And I didn't expect to study any kind of rural versus urban splits or divides. Saying this now, I feel very naive, but I didn't actually know that kind of sentiment was there in our state. I mean, I grew up in Wisconsin. I've lived here pretty much my whole life except for graduate school, and it was new to me. So probably the last time I talked, I don't know if I had started to think much about this rural versus urban divide, but after spending hours and hours in coffee shops and gas stations, like you said, it was sort of hard to avoid that a lot of people in smaller communities around the state just have a perspective of the cities, namely Madison and Milwaukee and the surrounding metro areas, getting more than their fair share and undeservedly so.
Before we get to some of the details about that, the rural-urban split and sort of perceptions of Madison, Milwaukee, can you say something about Wisconsin? As you know, even if you go back in history, it seems like we have a very weird political history of extremes where we're both the state that produced Joseph McCarthy and the John Birch Society, but we're also the state that produced Gaylord Nelson and Earth Day and so on. What's up with us?
Yeah, it is a fascinating place, isn't it?
Yeah, and I grew up here too.
Yeah, I know. And it's as time goes on, it becomes more and more interesting, doesn't it? I think there's just a very strong independent streak in this state, as well as a long history of trusting ordinary people to make up their own minds. So in a lot of our legislation historically, the way we had set things up as a state sort of put some of the burden on the ordinary citizen to make up his or her own mind, and also some of the freedom of doing that. And I think Wisconsin is, it's hard to peg exactly what we are at this point in time, but Wisconsin has always kind of struck me as a place where there were differences among us, but we had these ways of getting around them, whether they were mutual love of the Packers or just, common ways of spending our time. I think it's just been a place where there's been a lot of political freedom at the same time as there were sort of unwritten rules about what's too much in a way. And so we somehow, even though there were some extremes and some experimentation and such, very few occasions when people were trying to reel that in, because there was this sense that everybody was going to come back to the common or the fold at some point in time. And another strange thing about our politics is that sometimes when I'm out and about talking about Wisconsin, people sometimes say, well, how is it that you had Joe McCarthy and La Follette in the same state, right? Well, part of that history is that they were both, at one point in time, Republicans of the Republican Party. And because our Republican Party had such a strong hold on the politics of the state for the better half of the 20th century, there was a lot of variation within it. So,
we also seem to be a state that is increasingly designated a swing state, or where it might go Republican for governor and Democratic for president, or where we might have two senators where one would be a Tea Party candidate, the other openly gay, or, very mixed matched.
Yeah.
Where it would be difficult to put a label on what Wisconsin is.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that goes back to who turns out in different elections. So in presidential election, it's true across the country, and it's true in Wisconsin too, that at this point in time, the electorate tends to skew more towards the Democratic Party during presidential elections, because the turnout tends to be greater and tends to include a greater group of people who lean to the Democratic Party. And in off-year elections, the electorate has tended to lean Republican. So that helps to explain some of it. And I think when you're in a state like Wisconsin, which is purple, it's not that – I emphasized the independent streak before, but it's not that there's just vastly disproportionately more independence here, but that there are a lot of Democrats and there are a lot of Republicans. We're kind of split down the middle. When you're in a place like that, who turns out can matter quite a bit for who gets elected.
When you set out to go listen to people in coffee shops and gas stations and all around, how did you figure out, first of all, how many people and groups and places you'd need to go to before it was in order to make it statistically relevant, as opposed to sort of more anecdotal? And how did you find where these groups were and how to sort of be like this invisible fly that could record things and not influence them?
Well, for the statistical relevance, what I was aiming for was not necessarily to generalize to all of Wisconsin. What I initially was looking for was insight in the way people's socioeconomic background or social class identity mattered for the way they made sense of politics. So I tried to get a wide range of places that varied by median household income and types of jobs and job security. And I assumed that if I went to places that varied in those things, I would end up listening to people who varied in those things across the state. And so my point wasn't to necessarily, in a statistical way, be able to generalize to a broader population, but just to spend enough time with a wide variety of people that I would get some insight on how social class varied with the types of political views I was hearing. And along the way, I stumbled, sounds kind of funny, but it occurred to me that there was this strong rural versus urban divide. I still had to struggle with how many groups is enough, though. And with this style of work, usually what I look for is, with every subsequent group that I add to the sample, am I learning something substantially different from what I thought I was seeing, or is this sort of confirming in my mind that the types of patterns that I think I'm seeing? So I started off with 27 communities, and I added some gradually to try to give me a little more variation in age and type of place. But after, I think I ended up with 36 groups in all, and, 5 years of fieldwork with them, I felt like, okay, I'm pretty confident that this kind of rural resentment is going on. But to find the groups, UW Extension, Cooperative Extension, was just a gold mine of knowledge, because our wonderful extension, at the time, there was an office in each of our 72 counties. And those folks, those extension educators, really know their counties. They know their communities really well. So when I sampled a community, I was able to call up the extension office and say, where in such and such Wisconsin do people get together on a regular basis that I can just invite myself into? And they knew. Sometimes they had to ask around a little bit, but if they themselves didn't know, they knew somebody who would, and sure enough, they pointed me to, the regulars in the gas station or the diner or the church.
You talk about some of the groups. Some of them had kind of funny names, too. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it's something like the Mediocre Redneck Group,
right?
Coffee Clatch or something.
Yeah, right, and which is just, their way at, that name does a lot of things. It points out that they perceive that urbanites see folks like them as rednecks. And also the mediocre bit was just really endearing, because they weren't mediocre in any stretch of the term. These are people who, with real lives and real struggles and a whole lot of humor, just really delightful to spend time with. But that label, the mediocre redneck club, just so selfie-facing.
And how did you, let's say you're approaching a group like that or somewhere else in the state, and here you come, University of Wisconsin professor doing research, that already puts you in a class that may be looked at very suspiciously.
Yeah.
What did you do so that the conversation you would hear would not be sort of an artificial construct that would change because of your presence?
Yeah. It's a great question. I think it helped that I'm just kind of an ardently optimistic person, which can be bad and can be good. So when I started this project, I didn't expect to encounter hostility towards University of Wisconsin-Madison or people in Madison. And so my first year of walking in cold call to a coffee clutch in a gas station at 5:30 a.m., I'm relatively shy, so it was a little bit of a trick, but walking in and saying, hi, I'm Kathy from University of Wisconsin-Madison, I didn't expect people to be mean. I sort of expected people would say, well, we don't really want to spend our morning talking with you, or something along those lines, but that never happened. But I guess what I did was just to take a deep breath and walk in with as much sincerity as possible, because I knew from previous work that if you can convey to people in a short amount of time that you actually are interested in who they are and what they think, it goes a long way toward them wanting to engage with you,
Right. Now, you talk about in the book, Politics of Resentment, you talk about the M&Ms, Madison and Milwaukee, and the sort of unique way those are seen outside of those two cities. Tell us about that in terms of first, you know, with Madison and then also with Milwaukee, what makes them unique and how they're perceived once you leave those boundaries.
Yeah. So there are a lot of differences between the two. But one thing that really struck me was the way that many people beyond the Madison and the Madison-Milwaukee metropolitan areas talk about those two things, those two places as of a piece, as of the M&Ms, right? And basically the perspective had three main parts to it, as I understand it. It was, well, first, this sense that I'm proud to be a small town Wisconsinite or a rural Wisconsinite. People wouldn't really use those terms, but they would talk about their community or places like this or people like us. And they were often referring to their identity as part of a certain geography in the state. And the three parts of the resentment were basically this sense that small towns like ours, speaking as someone from a small town, don't get their fair share of resources in the state. They don't get their fair share of decision-making power, and they don't get their fair share of respect. So it's this sense that taxpayer dollars get sucked away from their community and spent on the big cities and not in an equitable fashion on small towns in Wisconsin. At the same time, that decisions, whether we're talking about in the state legislature or in state agencies or even at the university, are made without sufficient listening to small town folks, that they're made down there in the cities and communicated outward, and they're not really made with attention to the values and the concerns of people in small town Wisconsin. And then the last part is this sense that it's not just that the people in the city suck our money away and don't listen to us, but they actually don't respect us. They don't understand what life is like, so that level of respect. But also, they think we're a bunch of redneck, mediocre people, right? That there's this there's a perception that there's a stereotype among urbanites that people living in small towns are backward, not sophisticated, uneducated, not concerned about big issues in life. And all those things together are what I'm talking about when I talk about the resentment toward the cities.
Well, it's kind of funny on another level is that sometimes Wisconsin can be seen that way by, you know, New York, Washington,
yes,
D.C., et cetera. I know, you know, my mother was a reference librarian, and when she did a fellowship at Harvard Library, she had people who acted surprised that there were any libraries in Wisconsin, as if it was just, you know, dairy barns or something, that the condescension of, say, the East Coast toward a place like Wisconsin, it seems as if that's then being reflected in the way someone in small town Wisconsin sees the state legislature or the urban areas as well. And are they right? I mean, in other words, if you take this perception that the tax dollars from Wisconsin are disproportionately being sucked into Milwaukee and Madison, is that borne out by the facts?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, when I, with the help of some great graduate students here at UW-Madison, Ben Toff and Sarah Niebler in particular, and also Dave Lawson helped on this too, they're all on to their respective great careers now. We looked at 2010 census data and federal and state allocation of dollars. And when you look at the amount of money, I'm trying to think of a word besides taken, but taken from counties across the state and then how much money goes back to those counties and look at kind of how rural the counties are, it's not actually the case according to that calculation. So looking per capita, that rural counties are getting less than their fair share than more urban counties.
So you're saying they do get their fair share per person?
If we're saying fair share is, are they paying in a lot more to the collective pot, whether we're talking state taxes or federal taxes, than they're getting back compared to other counties across the state? It's not the case that rural counties are getting back way less than they put in. But that's only part of the story, is the way I explain it. Like, then you could stop there and say, see, they don't know what they're talking about. They're getting plenty of money back. And the urban counties aren't faring all that great either in terms of the number of dollars they're getting back because, you know, we're all putting into the pot. But then when you look at median household income and poverty levels and unemployment rates, all those things are worse in our rural counties in Wisconsin, according to 2010 data. And in my mind, those are the things that are more apparent to people, because nobody's sitting around doing these calculations on fair share except me and a few other, you know, state and federal policy makers and academics. But you can see poverty and you can know who's unemployed in your, you know, you hear
so
the stories.
You're saying that the poverty and unemployment rate is worse in the rural areas than it would be in, say, Milwaukee?
Yeah, and in Wisconsin, according to 2010. And that's not to say that it's not bad in Milwaukee, mm-hmm. right? But when you plot out across all 72 counties, household income as well as poverty rates and unemployment rates, they're worse in our more rural counties. So it's when people are in small town Wisconsin looking around and saying, we're having a really rough go of it here. Who's listening? Who's paying attention? That's accurate.
And is some of that the fate of small businesses and family farms?
And it's so many things, right? It's the change in farming, the loss of family farms, the loss of stores on Main Street. You know, a lot of our small towns in Wisconsin, you don't need to talk to anyone. You can drive down Main Street and see that things have changed from what they once were, right? There's that, and there's also the way technology is leaving some communities behind. I mean, broadband access is not the same across all mm-hmm. places in the state. It's, you know, where young people are choosing to live these days. That's a part of it, too. There's so many different things coming together to make people in small towns, you know, understandably look around and think, something's wrong here. Something's off. Things are changing in a way that's not healthy for my community, and I'm wondering who's paying attention to that.
Sometimes it seems Madison is also code for liberal, and Milwaukee is a code for racial minorities, and we're going to talk about those issues when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. We're strange to Madison. They want us to do everything for Madison's laws and the way they do things, but we totally live differently than the city people live. So they need to think more rural instead of all this city area. All the things they do, they're based on Madison and Milwaukee, never us. Yeah, we don't have the advantages that they give their local people there, I think, a lot of times. And it's probably because they don't understand how rural people live and what we deal with in our problems. Those are remarks from members of a group meeting in northwestern Wisconsin in a small town. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Catherine Kramer. We're talking about her book, The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin and the Rise of Scott Walker. Those comments give you that sense of the politics of resentment. I hear that in that voice. Yeah. You know, the idea that we're strange to Madison and right. they don't think about us. Tell me about that conversation.
Right. Yeah, well, that was the first time I met that group. I think that was in late spring of 2007. And I was just asking them, basically, what does UW-Madison not do so well? And we had just talked about what UW-Madison does well. They had lots of great things to say, but their response was this response of, we're just strange to Madison. We're strange to UW-Madison. We're strange to Madison. We're strange to people in the cities. And then they flesh that out, you know, saying we're so distant and people don't have a sense of what life is like up here. And I have to say, you know, when I started this project, I describe myself as a small town Wisconsinite to people because I grew up in Grafton, but Grafton now is very much part of the Milwaukee metro area. And when I was growing up, it was 7,000 people, and it's really not a small town. And I have to say that going to a place and discovering that the meeting place in town is a church basement on Tuesday mornings was strange to me. You know, that was new to me. And at the same time that I was learning about these perspectives, I mean, I was truly experiencing the divide. You know, I was experiencing what it's like to drive around in small town Wisconsin in a Volkswagen Jetta and have people say, you know, what do you do for a living? How is it that you're out here driving around the state having coffee with us? So, I mean, in that conversation, they're telling us as a collective readership about this divide. And they're also saying to me, like, you might not quite get what we're all about here. We appreciate you coming out and listening to us, but you're one of those city people, and let us tell you, like, we're quite a world away from Madison.
One time when I realized the difference between what it would be like to come out of a small town in Wisconsin and what it would be like, as I did, to grow up in Madison, was when I had an undergraduate student in my class of 400. And there were more people in my lecture than she had in her entire town. I don't remember if it was Oconee Falls or Balsam Lake or one of those places. And she came to class as a freshman and just was in shock. So I suggested that she sit in the front row, that we meet, you know, but just to kind of get over that culture shock that it can be for someone who is not used to a city at all. And I remember that she said her parents were terrified that she would pick up the values of Madison. Can you talk a little bit about that? It wasn't really in that conversation from the basement exactly, but I think underlying a lot of the resentment is also this sense that Madison represents a kind of different value system.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely came across that perspective quite a bit, whether we're talking in more kind of in a technical religious sense, like a fear that here we've spent all this time bringing up our kids according to typically, I mean, in these conversations almost always according to strict, not strict, people wouldn't say strict, but like Christian moral upbringing, right? And this fear that coming to Madison, somehow the students would lose that. And also this sense that it's just so politically left that they wouldn't have any choice but to come back as a communist. You know, I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but there really is this perception that there's kind of constant protest, no room for any type of political disagreement here, and so it's inevitable that a person coming to school here in those formative years is going to come back as anything but a radical lefty, right?
You're right. You also mentioned in your book that there's some resentment in the state for feeling that their children won't compete necessarily to get into the spots at UW-Madison, that they might be looked down on or something by the admissions folks.
Yeah, I ran across that quite a bit. And partly it was a perception of even just would they have the ACT scores? Would they be able to compete from kids from the Milwaukee suburbs or the Madison School District, for example, who had all kinds of college prep courses and AP and
foreign languages
and
more opportunities? Because that's another way that maybe somebody that's in a rural area would feel disadvantaged is if you are smaller, you don't have the same kinds of resources sometimes pooled together in terms of education.
Yeah, right. And I mean, our rural school districts definitely have a lot of challenges in front of them. Part of that conversation, too, was really illuminating for me in the ways it was around what kind of knowledge is valued. So sometimes we'd have these conversations about how prepared students were, and it would come back around to this kind of this difference people make between kind of common sense or common knowledge and book learning.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a lot to do with kind of the social class differences I was hearing about, too. And so in people sort of just job experiences that people have and kind of the difference between being able to work with your hands or to kind of do some kind of manual job or manual labor and the kind of common sense that comes along with that, and the ability to actually make things or fix things or do things with a visible result, as opposed to kind of knowledge-based industries, right? Sitting behind a desk all day, pushing paper, working at a computer.
Ivory tower learning.
Yes.
Yes. Things like that. I know one poem that I like to do with the non-traditional adult students that I work with in the Odyssey Project, who often feel that they've been labeled not college material, is it's a poem by Langston Hughes called PhD, where this guy gets a PhD and feels very smart, but he actually knows nothing because he hasn't lived. He hasn't been out there kind of experiencing the part that's outside of the books. When you talk to people about Milwaukee or also about some of the things going on in Madison, to what extent does race figure in? Because we do know that as you move outside of those areas, Wisconsin does become a very white state.
For sure. Yeah. Well, it was a fascinating time to be in the field doing this study with respect to race, because when I first started, Barack Obama was sort of on the radar, but not quite. And then, lo and behold, he's running for president, right? Becomes president, reelected. That in and of itself was a fascinating time to hear people talk about race. As you might expect, my initial attempts to get people to talk about race didn't work so great. People are afraid of talking about race and talking about it honestly. But what I heard, I learned a lot about race through this project, I have to say, because when I learned that when people are talking about those people in Milwaukee, 10 years ago, if I had heard that phrase, I would have automatically assumed that that's about race, that here comes a racist statement, right? But what I learned is that is what people then went on to say, it was very complicated, because when people were talking about those people in Milwaukee or those people in Madison, and then I should separate the two for a moment, but they were often talking about people like me, white, educated liberals, and people's resentment towards people of color was often intertwined with this sense of themselves not getting their fair share. And so the one thing that I learned about race is how racism is alive and well, you know, that was not a revelation I had to make. I mean, we know that. But that part of the reason it's so complicated and so difficult to overcome in our country is the way in which it's so bound up with our notions of who's deserving and who works hard and people's own sense of economic insecurity, right? I mean, race from the get-go is intertwined with our economy, and the fact that we've never overcome that or dealt with that means that when people are making assessments of who has power and who's getting what and whether they ought to or not, race is in that conversation, even when people aren't talking about people of color, for example. It's in the story of how we understand ourselves and how we understand our cities. So
you mean, for example, if I'm somebody from a small town and I feel we're not getting our fair resources, we're not getting the right kind of attention, embedded in that, are you saying that it might be implied that that's because tax dollars are going to support welfare and to support benefits or to bring in people who are not even documented? Or is that then sort of, I'm not getting what I need because it's going to others who are not like me?
Yeah, I think so. And yet it's not just that people are saying people of color are getting more than they ought to and I'm not. It's that may be partly implied by a given individual, but oftentimes they're talking about the undeserving in our population, including oftentimes liberal elites who are in favor of policies that might allocate resources to people of color. So it's partly even when people aren't calling out people of color, they're calling up a whole system that they think is unfair, and all the people who they believe are misunderstanding their own needs and not understanding the ways of life in their own community.
I wonder how different it would have been if you were getting some of these comments, you know, those kind of rooms they use when you're making a statement to the police, or sometimes being observed behind a window where you can see them and they can't see you. The reason I'm wondering about that is because, you know, recently, just in terms of a letter to the editor that I wrote that had to do with race and Madison, I was surprised by the number of anonymous, venomous, racist comments, where if people don't have to have their name and face behind what they're saying, it's kind of shocking, the lack of civil discourse. So, you know, and what a lot of my African-American and Latino students say is that in Wisconsin, the racism may not be blatant like in the South. You know, they may not be called something to their face, but that it's insidious, which is actually, it can be worse. And I was just wondering if you were trying to figure out what's really thought about race in all over the state, how you would really get the honest answers there.
That's a great question. And I guess I would, and I would turn it on its head a little bit to say, when you study public opinion, you face that question a lot, not necessarily just about race, but in general, of how do you know what you're getting, say, when you observe a conversation, is actual opinion, right? Wouldn't people say something different when they're in a phone interview with some interviewer they've never met, never going to see, don't even know who that person is? And the way I think about it is, well, both of those things are true in quotes, if you will, right? That what I say to you here in this radio show is true. I'm actually saying it. What I say in another context might also be true, just given what's important, what we've both been thinking about, who's around us, who can hear us, right? And so in a way, that what people said to me about Milwaukee or about race in these conversations, when we talked about Barack Obama, and I said, Barack Obama just won the Iowa primary. Are you surprised? And then we'd have a conversation about how, no, I mean, I think it's time that a black person run the country. Or I like him a lot. He seems very reasonable to me. Comments like that. You know, for me, what it does is show just how important face-to-face conversations are, because the junk we get in these anonymous means of communication is so caustic and so awful that it just reminds me how important it is for us to say things to each other in a face-to-face venue, because hopefully it's much less venomous. It better be, because...
Well, I think, I bet if you surveyed how many people have families where they have trouble talking about politics because there are divides within that family, and people get very heated. I have heard in numerous places that the divide in the United States in general, not just in Wisconsin, is bigger. There's a bigger gap than almost any other time in terms of people not listening to each other, in terms of people getting news only from the sources they already agree with, and then sort of not budging.
I
know you went back to some of these groups at several different points. Would it be fair to say that people don't change, or did you see change?
I think I did see change, and even now, as I've gone back to some of the groups to give them a copy of this book and have a little conversation about how they're doing and, you know, what they're thinking about this presidential election. And again, it's not a cross-section of the whole state, so I can't necessarily generalize from these groups, but I can tell you in the groups that I've spent time with since 2007, the big change I've seen is an increasing reluctance to talk about politics. It's ebbed and flowed a little bit. In early 2011, After Act 10, after the protests here at the Capitol, there were a lot of very raw emotions, and a lot of groups were very reluctant to talk with one another. And that's changed a little bit over time. I think a lot of those groups have repaired themselves, and they seem to be getting along just fine when I go back now. But I think people are more careful in a way, and there are some things that just don't seem to come up in these conversations.
Well, you could lose friends.
Yeah, a lot of people did.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Act 10 and the protesters at the Capitol, the recall election. We're going to talk about that and what that reveals about splits between rural and urban Wisconsin when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. A man working with the milking machines looks around the back of the cow and says, "I'm glad Walker did what he did. It's about time someone takes something away from those bastards." That's one of the comments quoted in The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin and the Rise of Scott Walker by my guest, Catherine Kramer. So let's talk about the whole situation with the recall, Act 10, the protesters, and how, because you had been working on this study of how people think about politics in other areas of the state, how you saw what was happening maybe in a different way than others would have seen it. Can you kind of walk us through what happened?
Sure. Well, when the Act 10 legislation, as probably a lot of your listeners know, was a huge blow to public employees, you know, required public employees to pay in more for their health care insurance and their pension, and then also just the end to collective bargaining for most public employees was, you know, many public employees felt that as an attack against people like them. And here in Madison, there's lots of public employees, you know, full disclosure, we both are, right?
Included teachers and firefighters and all kinds of state workers.
That's right. And many people in Madison would say, how can this happen? Like, how can Governor Walker do this? Who's supporting this? Who would be in favor of this? And having done the field work that I had was well into at that point, 3 years into, I don't want to say that I understood it all or had all the answers, but it wasn't all that surprising to me, because what I had heard in other parts of the state was this strong sense that, look, I am working my rear off to make ends meet, and my taxes keep going up. I can't afford health care insurance for myself or for my family, and I'm paying taxes so that public employees can have health care? How does that work? Where's the fairness? Where's the justice? I mean, justice is my term. I don't think people said that term to me. But I knew that there was this strong sentiment out there that things are out of whack. Public employees have it really good, and I'm struggling, and health care is a huge concern. And there's no light at the end of the tunnel. Looks like as things go on, I'm less and less able to afford health care, and somehow public employees still have it, and I'm paying for it. So it seemed to me, you know, when Act 10 came along, although it was surprising to me as well, it made sense, and it seemed like a pretty, like, politically savvy move.
So when the recall election happened and people in Madison were pretty convinced that there would be, you know, that the governor would be recalled, that didn't happen and it wasn't close. And you referred to that at one point as a rural landslide.
Yeah.
Explain.
Well, you could, at the time, just driving around Madison and then driving around other parts of the state. There were all these visuals about which parts of the state were going to be supporting Governor Walker and which parts weren't, right?
In you mean Madison, yard signs?
Yeah, I mean yard signs, bumper stickers, homemade signs, right? Deer stands turned into advertisements for Governor Walker, you know? I mean, it was incredible to me how different visually the context was politically at the time. So Madison, it was clear there was no way Governor Walker was going to survive that recall, right? And then you drive, if you drove straight north 4 hours from here, 4 or so hours, I mean, pretty much you get outside of, not that far outside of Madison. You started seeing Stand with Walker, Stand with Walker, Stand with Walker, I Stand with Walker, We Stand with Walker. So it was a rural landslide, and just electorally, which counties went against the recall or in favor of Governor Walker. But also, in my mind, it wrapped in with this sentiment, this rural resentment towards the cities. Just the Act 10 legislation itself very much tapped into this sense that Madison, Milwaukee, getting more than their fair share, and somebody's got to do something about it.
And so then Walker becomes a hero standing up to the M&Ms, standing up for the little guy.
Yeah, that's right.
You mentioned in your book that in some ways what happened in Wisconsin with that recall election and some of the sentiment that you're seeing, in some ways it's like a microcosm for the country at large. I saw somewhere that, I think it was a Fox News commentator that referred to Donald Trump as a blue-collar billionaire.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Can you talk about the sort of parallels that you see between some of the rural urban resentment right here in Wisconsin and then some of the split that we're seeing in the presidential 2016 election?
Sure. So it's funny. Almost as soon as I sent the book off to the publisher for the final time, I guess the 2016 presidential election was really ramping up, and I had the time to sort of look up from Wisconsin and think more intensely about how what was going on in Wisconsin was fitting into more global trends. And it seems to me that one thing that's going on is that everybody is trying to make sense of some really significant shifts in our world, whether it's globalization or demographic changes or changes in technology and the way we relate and communicate with one another, that cities have become symbols of kind of change and flux and all of the very diverse country that we are becoming, both culturally, religiously, and there are, for many people, I would say for many people that is a source of uncertainty, and for many people it's a source of intense anxiety, right, in a sense that things have gone off the rails. And if we could only get back to what we once were, right? Like, make America great again, right? It's like this slogan that taps into this sense that wherever we're headed is not right, right? It's like it's not in line with who we think of ourselves at, like what a true American is. And even though, I mean, Donald Trump is an urban person, right? I mean, we were just joking
towers.
About Trump Towers, right? Mm-hmm. That he has tapped into this sentiment of that, like, urbanicity or the direction that our cities are headed is not in line with what many people think to be, like, the true path of America, right? That it's, we've gotten off track somewhere along the lines and we just need to steer it back on track. And not let in certain groups of people, not be welcoming to certain groups of people, not to allow certain types of behavior.
It's interesting when election results do come in any national election, and also they show different congressional and gubernatorial elections, that it's so different county to county. You know, you'll see somebody maybe win in, you know, an urban area and then totally not win once you go outside of that area. And that's not just Wisconsin, but all over the country.
Yeah.
That's what county you're from is very different.
Yeah, that's right. And it's some of that you can explain away by occupational background or income level and such. But now, after having done this study, I think a lot of it also is sort of the cultures that we create in those places and the kind of the perspectives that we pass on to our kids in those places, and how we perceive the world and how we think about cultural difference and embrace it or not, or see it as something that we ought to guard ourselves against. And so I think it's, you know, that electoral pattern of more rural areas going Republican and more urban areas going Democratic has been, you know, on our radar for a long time. But I think now we're beginning to understand that it's, you know, it's not just socioeconomic background, but that there are cultural differences in this country that kind of go along with the type of place in which you're living.
You also talk about, both in Wisconsin and beyond, people voting against their own interests. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. You know, I really try not to use that phrase, because I think a lot of times political observers, we do talk about that. We talk about how can it be that people don't support healthcare reform when they clearly need healthcare themselves, right? Healthcare insurance themselves. But in my mind, and increasingly now, especially after having written this book, that interests are so subjective, that how we see the world very much colors what we think is right and good for us or for people in general. And there, you know, you can try to assume what is in someone's interest, but even when you're sitting across the table from someone who is concerned about not having health insurance, they have legitimate reasons for why they might not want support universal health care or some kind of major reform in national health care legislation. And those reasons might not be my reasons, but they come from actual true experience. So it's not for me to say whether it's in someone's interest or not.
So in the few minutes that we have left, what's the take-home message here? Is it that we need to listen to each other more? You know, what would you want people, if they read The Politics of Resentment, to come away thinking and doing?
Yeah, I'd say two main things. One is to listen to each other more. And it's really hard, but it's not very hard. I mean, it's hard in the sense we all have relationships in which we know there's some significant political difference or about a difference about something we care deeply about. And those relationships can be really uncomfortable. And yet, it's not that difficult in the sense that if you sit down with someone and say, tell me what you think, and just shut up and don't say anything and listen to
them. It is hard.
Yep. But it's one of these tools that we all have at our disposable, at our disposal. We just need to exercise it a bit more. And I know that I'm being a little bit Pollyanna-ish about that. It's difficult, but it's so necessary in a democracy. We have to be able to listen to one another. We have to be able to understand one another, because ultimately we're making decisions about each other's lives. And the other thing I would say is that we need to pay more attention to the common good. We need to pay more attention to the fact that we all are in a democracy, and that we're trying to do this collective project together, which we're continually trying to figure out as we go along. It's never going to be something that we have figured out and it's done. There's always going to be change. We're always going to be trying to figure out how to live with one another and how to govern each other in a just fashion. And we need to pay more attention to that fact, just that we are in a democracy together, and we better figure out
the imperfect perfect union.
Right.
Like
yep.
My guest has been Kathy Kramer. Her book, The Politics of Resentment, explores rural consciousness in Wisconsin and the rise of Scott Walker. Thanks for being with me, Kathy.
Thank you for having me, Emily.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.